Well, I was born in the city of Detroit to Southerners. My mother was from Natchitoches, Louisiana. My father's family was from Georgia, and they were attracted to Detroit's vibrant economy at that time because of the auto industry. And my father, worked hard and worked his way. First, went to the army at an early age. Then worked his way through Wayne State University, went to University of Michigan Medical School, practiced medicine as a psychiatrist for many years. I have four brothers, including me, two older, two younger. And the older two are still there, and the younger two are in North Carolina in Boston. And my father was had no interest in religion really at all. And my mother was a devoted Catholic 2 times a week. I went to Catholic school. I went to public school as an elementary, junior high, and high school. Went to Catholic school, all boys Catholic high school. And I was a young person who we were raised in a house where ideas were floated around freely. My mother made sure we understood things like the civil rights movement. Her father, Frank Martinez, was organizing black voters in rural Minnesota in the early 50s. And you could easily get killed doing that, easily. And he was doing that kind of thing, and she was proud of it and shared it with us. And I never met my grandfather, but my mother felt made me feel like I did. She would tell us about how they burned a cross in front of their house, and how they would, when he would be out driving around, they'd pull trees out in the middle of the road, and he'd have to wonder whether or not, if he got out, whether he'd be shot, And there were a lot, and he and she described how even my great grandmother, he got a lot of people to register to vote, but he never could get her, because she just was thinking that's white folks' business, you know what I mean? And so, when I got to Wayne State, I had already read the autobiography of Malcolm X and was captured by it, was interested and intrigued by Islam because of it, and certainly was amazed by people like Muhammad Ali. And so wanted to know, well, what's got hit, what is this thing he's talking, this Islam stuff, what is it? And so I never really knew any Muslims or any had much to do with it until I got to be I think I was a sophomore. And I think it was a Friday, and a friend said he was going to go to Jumu'ah prayer, and I asked him. Now he didn't actually say that's where he was going to. He said he had to go, so he pick up the books and see you later. Where are you going? Well, I'm going to this thing called Jumu'ah prayer. Really? What's that? Come on, check it out. So that's it.
Well,
19
you're at
years.
Wayne State.
Yeah, I was 19, and I also got introduced to a lot of other things at that age.
So then how did then the intersection of Islam sort of inform, your activism at that time? Or was there any sort of intersection or, for,
Yeah, they
social
blended.
change, sort of justice in society?
Yeah, Islam spoke to justice for me, And in many ways, justice is one of the more prominent ideas in Islam, justice, because where there's justice, where there's fairness, where there's advocacy for the poor, for the wayfarer, for the persecuted, love can sprout within that environment. But if you don't have justice, then our relationships are all tarnished by the imbalance of power among us. And that's not to say everybody should have the same degree of power. I mean, the necessity of society means that there are going to be parents and there'll be children, there'll be bosses and there'll be workers, there'll be these things are just the reality we live in. But everybody has rights and everybody has to have respect and everybody has to have justice. So good relationships can flower within a relationship of justice. But if you don't have any justice, well, you can't have no peace. Well, I probably, when I reflect back on my life, I probably sought Islam and was attracted to it as a refuge from, discrimination, racism. I thought it was just marvelous that when I walked into the MSA as a 19-year-old, that some were white, white as this paper. Some were a little shade darker, some were another shade darker, some were black as that portfolio, all brothers and sisters in Islam. And I really could, and being in America, we're race-minded, you know what I mean? Because this is the culture we come from. So I was a little bit surprised. I said, you know, do these white Muslims really respect these black Muslims? And over time, I felt like this is an American problem, not theirs. You know what I mean? And that this is not something that, and that people really could live, you know, in a state of, not that all Muslims do the right, Muslims do a lot, you know, Islam might be, you know, no doubt within Islam, but Muslims' behavior is different, right? And Muslims are flawed because they're human, right? But they have this thing to strive towards that I think allows them to continue to promote justice, promote brotherhood, sisterhood, equality. As a Muslim, you know, I've matured because it started out as a refuge, and now for me it's a way of living and perspective that feeds my soul and bolsters me, strengthens me, and allows me to continue to try to do the right thing for myself, my family, and my community. In spite of adversity, in spite of difficulty, and even in good times, because good times can be adversity too, because they can lead you to be thinking you're doing all this, you know, and that's a challenge, you know, and then when the trouble comes, you know, you know Islam is there, so it's been a wonderful journey for me, and I'm just so glad, you know, that my good friend Mafta invited me to Juma many years ago. Yeah.
So then you're elected and you take your swearing in photo with your hand on the Quran.
Well, you know, it's funny, that has its own story and evolution. Mm-hmm. You know, before I won the election, I was on Somali cable television. Mm-hmm. Now, who watches late night public access Somali cable television? In Somali. Well, I guess right-wing radio talk show hosts do. Because a friend of mine was like, well, Brother Keith, if you, his name is Muhammad Anti. Yeah, I don't know if you know Anti. Anyway, he works for the BBC now. He's like, Brother Keith, if you win your election, will you swear in on the Quran? I said, I haven't won my election yet. Will you just, you can imagine winning, right? I said, yes. Well, imagine winning and you're going to swear in. Do you swear in on the Quran? Okay, Auntie. I would do it, you know? And, because I hadn't even thought about it. So then the right wing started spinning it out. The spin machine started cranking. Mm-hmm. And was ginning up and moving. And then Dennis Prager got involved. And then this judge down in Alabama got involved. And then everybody was kind of a frenzy. Then there was a write-in campaign to members of Congress. Then members of Congress started writing back out, saying, we can't control what Keith Ellison does. And then they started sending me letters saying, we're with you, do whatever you want. In fact, there was a woman named Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's Jewish, from Florida, who swore in on the Tanakh, this holy book for Jews. And she said, you swear in on, you know, do it, do your thing, because I did it. Some people didn't like it, but I did it anyway, whatever. And then the night before, and then, you know, as the date was coming up, I was actually sitting in this office where we are right now. We got some mail in, and we get mail in every day. Mm-hmm. And so we opened up the letter. It was a handwritten note, and it said, you should swear in on the Quran of Thomas Jefferson, which is located in the Library of Congress. I said, this is a great idea. This is a fantastic idea. This is what we're going to do. So I can't claim to have come up with the idea, but I can claim that I know a good idea when I see one. Right? Right.
That's so true.
Right, right. So you know, we didn't tell anybody that's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. We're going to surprise them. But then I moved out to D.C., and the day before the swearing-in came, and, you know, actually, there's sort of like two swearing-ins. There's this real swearing-in, and then there's a ceremonial one. The one that is the one where we all swear in en masse with the speaker and we swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And then there's an individual one for your family. That's the one where I use the Quran. Mm-hmm. And right before I walked up to do this, you know, Nancy Pelosi says, "You can swear on anything you want." Shook my hand. The night before that big day came, Nancy Pelosi invited me to offer a prayer at a dinner that was being held for all the incoming freshmen. Mm-hmm. And after I offered the prayer, she said, "I want you all, my colleagues, to know that this is the kind of prayer that any one of us might offer." Yeah, but I went to the University of Minnesota, graduated in 1990, and I have four children, and two of them were born while I was in law school. My first son was born when I was a first year, when I was in a 1L mm-hmm. at University of Minnesota when I was about 24 years old. It seems amazing to me that somebody would go out and have kids at 24 years old and try to get through law school. Well, it can be done. I did it, you know. And then the second one came in my third year of law school. Yeah, so now they're both 22 and 21. And so time flies, you know. And then, you know, I went to work at Lequus and Venom. Lequus and Venom was a firm that I went to and enjoyed doing that work. That was I did commercial litigation, did some depositions, argued some motions, wrote a lot of briefs, and then it was a great place. But I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a justice lawyer. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I wanted to go to law school for. Sure. And Legal Supreme was good to me because it helped me deal with, getting my feet wet in terms of legal practice. And really, I got great training there, and I really feel like a part of the Linguist and Venom community. But the next step that I took was what I really wanted to do, and that was to be at the director of the Legal Rights Center. And I took a drop in pay, and my office went from the 42nd floor in the IDS Tower to the second floor on Chicago and Franklin. You know, we went from a full group of staff asking me what I needed and when I needed it, to a half the support staff, typing my own briefs, but it was great though. I loved every second of it. I'd never trade a moment of it. Mm-hmm. We had a staff of 20 people, and when I joined the staff, I was 29 years old. I was the youngest person on staff. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to listen to me, but yet, you know, that taught me something about managing people, and that was, just to borrow from a Christian idea, it was a baptism by fire. They throw me in the deep water and I had to swim, man, you know, and it was not easy. I had to, and because the staffers who had more experience than I did were, they didn't necessarily want to listen to this smart aleck young guy, you know. So, but anyway, over the time, you know, I won them over, and some of them I had to let go because they just wouldn't get on the right page. And then, but still, you know, we ended up getting a brand new building, establishing a street law program, representing a lot of people, helping a lot of people, fighting a lot of tough cases, and it was just fantastic, and I enjoyed every second. And I would have been glad to continue to do that work for many years. The only problem is I had more kids, and I had more bills, and I needed to make a living, and I couldn't do it there with all these kids I was having. So, I went to private practice, and from the day that I went to private practice until the day that I closed down my practice, we made money, you know, and I never was, we just it went like that. And so I never had to spend that day where I couldn't, you know, where, I mean, I had some rough patches along the way, as I remember, but it was fun the whole time, and somehow we were able to, you know, keep the lights on. Well, the Minnesota Muslim community is special for a whole range of reasons. One is its diversity. The other is it's the fact that it's a well-integrated community. Mm-hmm. And the other is that this is a community that is all about reaching out to the broader community in terms of civic engagement. Mm-hmm. But the Muslim community in Minnesota can be found engaged in an interfaith dialogue, can be found active in all aspects of life, whether it's teaching people about what's going on in Afghanistan or Pakistan, or whether it's teaching people what's going on with with their health care. You know, there's a Muslim-founded clinic in Bloomington, and there is and there are Muslims who help people organize their financial services. And again, like we host the largest Somali community in the United States, mm-hmm. and we're very proud of that because the Somali community gives forth great gifts to this community every day. And but we're also proud of other ethnic groups that are Muslim, including our Palestinian community, Turkish community, African American community, and we get along very well. And I'm gonna tell you, I've been to New York, Chicago, L.A., Northern California, Washington, Houston, Dallas, you name it, all throughout Florida, Connecticut, everywhere. And our community is among the most cohesive in the country because somehow we figure out ways to have disputes with each other, you know, and but yet here we're pretty tight. Another thing is we happen to have some pretty good neighbors. You know, you really don't hear a lot of there are intolerant things. There have been desecrations, mosques, and there have been intolerant comments uttered. But for the most part, the Muslim community, the Minnesota community, has been pretty hospitable to the Muslim community. And I compare that with New York, where they don't want, they're trying to stop block mosques in Sheepshead Bay, block the Lower Manhattan Islamic Center. I mean, there's like a hate industry there in New York. And in Wisconsin, Tennessee, you got these very unhospitable environments. And there have even been real problems in Chicago. And so the Muslim community in Minnesota has been, I think, well received by our neighbors, and that's a blessing, and we should thank God for it. Yeah, well, I think, you know, the Muslim community has been hosting the Muslim Day on the Hill, and we've been down at the state capitol, had a presence for several years now. I would say that's a great achievement. The Muslim community hosts Al-Amal School and other educational ventures. Muslims are involved in education. The Muslim community, as I said, has hosted the largest Somali community in the United States, which I think is a great asset, you know, to us. And I remember there was only a trickle, and then there was a flood. and now we have a very vibrant, diverse, and prospering community with challenges, but for the most part doing well. You know, the Muslim community has been able to host some of the premier small businesses. As a matter of fact, the Small Business Award of the Year gets handed out every year. Mm-hmm. And Majdi Wadi won it a few years ago. And this is a great award, an immigrant small business owner across the United States. And so we host, you know, Majdi, who won it, and we're so proud of him. But not only is he doing well over at Holy Land, I mean, they're doing well at Marina. They're doing well at the Falafel King. They're doing well. I could name a bunch of them. And then they're doing well over there at Carmel Mall. Carmel Mall is thriving. So is the 24th Mall. But then so is the Iranian restaurant over there on University. That was the Caspian, right? And you can go eat well at the Caspian. It's a great meeting place. And this speaks to the fact that, you know, we might be Somali, we might be Arab, we might be African American, we might be Iranian, we might be Turkish, but we're all one community, and we work together, do business together, and try to support each other, so you know this is a great asset, and I think there's been a lot of achievement, the successes are just hard to count because there've been many. You know, we've been really, really, really fortunate. When the American ambassador to Norway visited Minnesota, because we have a large Norwegian population and Swedish population, he wanted to go to the Somali Mall because he was interested in seeing how well integrated the Somali community was here. Now, again, you know, somebody could come in here and say, well, there's all kind of problems in the Somali community. And they could talk about youth violence and, you know, the fear of radicalization, and there's things people could talk about, but that is but let's not lose the 99% because of the 1%. You know what I mean? A lot of Europeans trying to figure out how to integrate new Americans are looking to how Minnesota does it. And, you know, it's interesting that the question of Sweden and Norway should come up because, you know, I've visited Europe many times and I enjoy it and I respect all of the European nations. But I think that the identity of a European nation is a very, very narrowly defined, right? So if you are Swedish or you are Swiss or French or a Brit, then you look a certain way, you speak a certain way, you eat a certain way. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if you don't fit into that tradition, then you're not really part of it. But in America, the day you swear in and are naturalized, you're as American as a president, which is, I think, a great thing. If you're born here, you're a citizen. Whereas a lot of them, you have generations who are not, you know? And, you know, this is great thing about our country. You know what I mean? This is the place where there's opportunity. You know, in the United States, you know, I mean, you know, we don't have certain fights. Like in France, they want to argue over hijab or no hijab, burqa or no burqa. In America, you wear what you want to wear. That's people's own business. You know, in Switzerland, they want to stop no minarets. Well, in America, we don't even understand the debate. And the truth is, there are people trying to import that way of thinking here. Mm-hmm. And I think we should hold on to our own traditions and say we believe in tolerance and religious freedom.
Moving past this discourse of, you know, Islamophobia, or mm-hmm. fear of Islam, and, you know, what sorts of actions do, you know, should Muslims and not Muslims be taking? You know?
I'm glad you asked that question because I actually urge Muslims to combat Islamophobia, not to protect Islam, but to protect freedom of faith generally. Because the truth is, it might be Muslims today, but it could be Jews tomorrow, or it could be Mormons the next day. And remember, this country at one time was very anti-Catholic, right? And there still are little strains of it. And when John F. Kennedy was trying to become the president of the United States, they said, well, he shouldn't be the president because he bows to a foreign dictator. And he'd be like, well, who are they talking about? Well, the Pope. I'm like, that seems silly to us. But that is what his detractors said. So the action we should take, we should work in our interfaith groups. We should not just get together and talk, but we'll do interfaith action. So why not get together Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and go out and, like, feed the hungry? You know what I mean? This is what we should do. You know, we should come together as people of faith. And people who are non-theists, so-called atheists, you know, we ought to remind them that, yes, people of faith cause a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And if we have wars and violence and stuff like that associated with religious people. But Pol Pot and Stalin were about atheists, you know? And so the problem is not religion or no religion. The problem is absolutism. My way or the highway. Do it my way or you will die, you know, or we will jail you, or we were going to do something bad to you if you don't follow my rigid idea of what should be. This is the concept. And so we have to fight absolutism. And there's nothing in the Quran or the Hadith or the Sunnah or the Sirah of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which suggests rigidity and non-flexibility. You know, I'm reminded of the Hadith where there's a brother who came in and was riding his horse and said, you know what? He said this to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. I almost ran into this post that was near the well. So I moved it. Prophet said, good. And somebody said, you know, came to the well, couldn't find it, so I put a post up. He said, that's good too. And so he said, well, how could they both be right? Because you got to be flexible in the situation. This is our faith. You should fast during Ramadan. But if you're sick, you can feed the poor. I mean, we don't have this rigid, my way or the highway, absolutist religion. There are rules, and people should follow them. But there are exceptions and accommodations throughout, as there should be. And anybody who wants to impose absolutism is wrong. no matter what, whether they're Muslim or any other religion or not of any, or if they're atheists or non-theists. So this is the thing. What we need to do in terms of action is to promote tolerance, inclusion, and we need to get about the real problems. There's Muslims who are interested in the environment. There's people who are not Muslim who are interested in the environment. Let's work on the environment together, you know? Homelessness, all kinds of problems. Let's get after it, you know? And let's promote peace.
Just one more question.
Okay.
I guess outside of being a congressman,
mm-hmm.
Who is Keith Ellison? How does he want to be represented in the historical sort of record?
You know, I'm basically just a civil rights worker. That's it. I'm just basically a civil rights worker. I just, you know, one day when they box me up, you know, I just, you know, tried to do the best I could with what I had, tried to promote justice. That's it. You know. Thank you. All right. Assalamu alaikum.